all set up then.
Okay.
All right. It occurred to me, I was asked a relatively short period of time ago to talk to you about clinical trials. So it occurred to me sometime in the night.
Can you stand by the microphone because it won't project? So the microphone is, you'll have to stand.
Oh, okay.
Here.
Sorry. Anyway, it occurred to me sometime last night or this morning that I'm referring to a bunch of clinical trials. And most of them I've been involved in. So I wanted to give you a list of those so that you know just a little bit about them. So if you look at your glossary, that glossary I handed out, nutritional prevention of cancer trial was conducted at the University of Arizona when I was there. It tested selenium to protect against skin cancer and among high-risk people who have already had a basal or squamous cell skin cancer. The ATPC trial was an international trial. It was conducted in Finland, and it tested alpha-tocopherol and beta-carotene. The idea was that alpha-tocopherol would protect against heart disease. Finnish men used to have very high heart disease rates, and it was largely because they smoked like chimneys. And beta-carotene was supposed to protect them against lung cancer, and it did neither drug worked in that trial, but it was a trial of some 30,000 Finnish men. The Women's Health Initiative was the Women's Health Initiative, and it was a trial of, there was a dietary intervention, there was a trial of estrogen, and a trial of vitamin D. And it was conducted, the total trial had over 100,000 women in it. Polyp prevention trial was a trial of dietary change for people who had had an adenomatous polyp, and the goal was to protect against another one. Select selenium and vitamin E was conducted in 35,000 men. It was to protect against prostate cancer, and it used these two agents. CALGB 70807, that's a trial I'm involved in. We're just about to unblind it. It's 465 men, and we took men who had low-grade, low-volume prostate cancer, and we wanted to protect against the development of high-grade disease, so we're changing their diets significantly. Wheat bran fiber trial was, as you might imagine, a trial of wheat bran fiber. We did this among men and women who had had an adenomatous polyp diagnosed, and we put them on this. Basically, we got the Kellogg's company. This was Dave Albert's idea, not mine, and it was when I was at the University of Arizona. We got the Kellogg's company to donate a 3-year supply of a high-fiber cereal, essentially Kellogg's All Bran. And we also got them to donate a 3-year supply for just a little less than 1,000 people of All Bran without any fiber in it. Now, they had to put a little bit of fiber in it because if you try to eat All Bran cereal without any fiber in it, it tastes like wallpaper paste. It's just pretty disgusting. So it had a little bit of fiber in it. But that was wheat bran fiber trial. SWOG 9917 was a trial of selenium for men and women who had high-grade prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, and that was a trial that I led. The Elestra trial, I can't sit still or stand still. The Elestra trial, there was a fake fat that had been developed by Procter & Gamble several years ago. And there was lots of, it's weird because people, how many of you drink regular Coke or regular soda or whatever? How many of you drink regular stuff? Now, how many of you only drink it if it's fat, no calorie? What do you people drink?
Water.
Oh, okay. Anyway, most normal people don't have any problem with consuming diet soda. But with fat substitutes, and olestra was one of these fat substitutes. It's called polyester sucrose. It was supposed to protect people against getting fat because it was this artificial fat, and if you consumed it, it would just kind of go right through. And unfortunately for Procter & Gamble, it went right through too fast. And so it was associated with the what you might call orange shorts syndrome. So it was also believed that it would make people sick. So there was a trial that was done in Chicago where people were randomized, and they didn't know what they were getting. They were randomized to get a great big box of popcorn, either with this fake fat in it or with real fat. And they consumed the stuff, and then the people who did the study called them the next day to see if they had gotten sick. So that was the olestra trial. They were randomized, they didn't know what they were getting. The FOBT trial was Jack Mandel's study of fecal occult blood testing to prevent colon cancer. It was conducted at the University of Minnesota, and it showed that fecal occult blood testing did, in fact, decrease the risk of colon cancer, but by a fair amount, but there were some other complications. Thomas's BSE trial was conducted in China. It was a trial in which women at a large industrial complex were asked to perform breast self-examination at regular intervals, and the idea was that this would protect against the development of disseminated disease. The risk was so low that the effect was statistically insignificant. MSC versus SEMET, that was a trial I did where we were looking at the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of two forms of selenium. And CARAT was the beta-carotene and retinol trial that was conducted to protect against lung cancer in people who were at high risk. Okay, let's go through these. That is just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about when I refer to these trials. Okay, how do we learn that an exposure alters risk or that an intervention decreases it and is efficacious? Now, I used to teach medical students, and I would say, how do we know this? How do we know that fat increases the risk of something or that this drug decreases the risk? And usually I would get a lot of silence, but when somebody would venture an answer, it was usually, well, you do it in a test tube, you do it in a laboratory. Well, for human beings, it's a little more complicated. The problem is that what you see in a petri dish does not always generalize to human beings, to huge human entire organisms. And what happens with animals doesn't necessarily happen with human beings. I've been involved in selenium research, and Dr. Rustam, who was a senior leader here at Roswell Park, said he had never seen anything have effects like selenium did in rats. But we have now done several trials of selenium supplementation in humans, and it's clear that what we saw in rats does not generalize to human beings. So there's a continuum of identification of approaches to prevention or to alteration of risk. So one is we use cell lines. Then we go to animal models. Then we go to phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials. And one of the questions that I dealt with when I was a leader here was that there's epidemiology, and we don't know how to handle epidemiologic data, and how does that lead to progression to clinical trials? Open question, and we're still arguing about it a great deal. Celecoxib colon cancer and CHD. This was a trial led by Monica Bertinoli. She's a professor of surgery at Dana-Farber and is the leader of the Consortium for Clinical Trials in Oncology Roswell's a member of it. She did this trial. She took folks who were sort of at risk of colon cancer, and she randomized them to celecoxib or to a placebo, watched them for several years, and sure enough, celecoxib prevented the development of colon cancer. But it also increased the risk of coronary heart disease, so that the number of people who died of heart disease was far greater than the number who died or were disabled by colon cancer. Okay, why do we need clinical trials? Well, we do those because we want to make it as difficult as possible for us to get the wrong answer. Now, we see people talking about research, and the question that, or the statement that almost always accompanies research is, well, we need more research. We do, but our goal is to stop the progress of cancer. We want to prevent it, we want to catch it earlier, we want to cure it. And all of the research in the world, unless it's leading to that, isn't worth anything. Just saying that something is interesting, it's not interesting unless it helps us get to an answer. So, what are the criteria for the validity of a treatment or prevention finding? First, there's the question of bias. Bias is defined as the wrong answer. If you say that something is no good and it actually works, it's wrong. It's just as wrong as saying it doesn't work and it actually does. Now, a lot of times you will hear people say that something is statistically significant or is not. That's generally beside the point. Statistical significance in the presence of bias doesn't save you anything. So, bias is the wrong answer. There's internal and there's external validity. What is internal validity? Somebody, you tell me. In research, you, sir.
Internal validity is making sure that the variables within your experiment like agree with each other and that they don't like contradict one another and that they're actually like qualifying variables.
Internal validity. You've done the study right. And in this group of patients or this group of animals or this group of cells, that answer is correct. External validity, next to him. You, ma'am.
You can generalize it to the population outside of your study population?
Yes. Does it generalize? So, if we do a really good study among white rats, like my friend Joe Rustem did, the question is external validity. Does it generalize to human beings? And one of the problems that NCI has, National Cancer Institute, has become aware of is that some populations are not represented in clinical trials. So, for example, in many prevention trials, the number or percentage of minorities is way lower than in the population. So the question that's asked is, does this study, which has to do with middle-class white folks who participate in clinical trials, have anything to do with the rest of the people in the world? Okay, information bias. Information bias. There is, in epidemiology, it's a big problem because we often ask people about their exposure to things. Now, even if they're trying their very best, their memories are usually pretty flawed. If they're as old as I am, they're very flawed. So there's mismeasurement of exposure. And in general, that will tend to decrease the association we see between an exposure and an outcome. Sample bias. If we select a certain group of people and study them, do we have external validity? Is that sample of people representative of the people to whom we want to generalize our studies? confounding bias. Confounding bias. If you look at the risk factors for breast cancer, and it's a good example, what are they? Tell me, speak up. Speak up. What are the risk factors for breast cancer? Oh, brother. You, ma'am, please. Right next to
right next to plastic.
HRT,
yep. Alcohol consumption.
Early menarche,
late menopause. It's a little bit confusing, but it looks like nulliparity is a risk factor for breast cancer. Alcohol consumption. Dr. Andersoni, who's here at Roswell, did a study that may have shown that cigarette smoking in the presence of certain genetic characteristics increases risk. So there's a whole bunch of risk factors. Now, if we do something like a case control study, so we have a group of breast cancer patients and a group of non-patients, and we say, okay, we look at their consumption of a vegetable, some vegetable, carrots, and the cases have less consumption than the controls, what do we say about that? You, sir.
Well, I think
say it loud so everybody can hear, and I can say it's wrong and they laugh at you.
So you mean there are two groups, one with breast cancer, one without?
Yes.
And those without breast cancer, those people eat more carrots?
Yes.
Like that?
Yes.
But I think we cannot, like, study just one factor like this, because there are so many different factors affecting those two groups. For example, those people who like carrots, maybe they healthier, like that.
Less likely to be fat.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Likely to get more physical activity. Physical activity appears to be protective. Okay, all of these factors that your fellow students have listed are probably pertinent. And the only way you could actually look at carrots alone would be to control, somehow or another, statistically control for all those other factors. And that's a very difficult thing to do. It takes huge samples. Now, one of the things we do, now pretend for the moment that you wanted to do something like randomize people to consume carrots. So this group of patients gets them, this group of patients doesn't. And let's say you have a big sample, and what your randomizing will do is lessen the probability of confounding due to all those other factors. So the hormone receptor status of the people who get carrots will probably be similar to that of the people who don't. The alcohol consumption of the people who get carrots, similar to that of the age of menarche of the two groups will probably be the same or similar. Okay, the purpose of randomization is to lessen the likelihood of confounding. And if there's anything you get out of today, that's probably an important one. We randomize to lessen the likelihood of confounding.
Now I probably screwed up the recording because I stepped away from the mic. Okay, statistical power and bias. You do a small study. You do a very small study. You get a statistically insignificant difference. That doesn't mean a lot, because you had very little statistical power. If you do a study and you've got six people in the study, three people get one treatment, three people get another, one person improves in group A, and two people improve in group B, and the difference is not statistically significant, it's because you didn't have enough statistical power. Actually, Jon Snow did the trial. No, I'm not Jon Snow. The guy who, somebody help me. The guy who did Admiral, what was his name? What the hell was his name? He was the guy who discovered vitamin C. Somebody help me with this. Sorry? Now, this guy was in the British Navy, and he had... Actually, the real impact of vitamin C was discovered before that, because what happened was, in the British Navy... Sorry? Yes. Sorry? Anyway, the guy had, there were 14 patients on ship, and they were all sick with scurvy. So he picked two to get an orange and a lemon per day. Two would get another treatment. Two would get a pint of seawater per day. Two would get some other god-awful mixture, and so on and so forth. And the only two who got better were the two who got vitamin C. But it was essentially a trial. And he said, in describing his findings, he said these two were the worst of all. And they got better within a couple of days and started helping to take care of the other folks. It was a randomized trial of 14 people. It was barely statistically significant. Very small study. Okay, moving on. Important to change. What you do in a clinical trial, is you change people's exposure. Now, epidemiology has traditionally looked at the association of the intake of something with risk. But in a clinical trial, you look at change. In the nutritional prevention of cancer trial, people got selenium supplements. In the ATBC trial, people got vitamin E and alpha tocopherol. Now, these trials are expensive. The Women's Health Initiative cost $800 million. The polyp prevention trial that I was that I directed from UB, well, I directed one site of the polyp prevention trial, cost $40 million. SELECT cost somewhere between $180 and $140 million. Actually, I was talking about the SELECT trial at a meeting, and I said, you know, we just spent $180 million on an intervention that didn't work. And somebody from NCI piped up and said, oh, no, we didn't spend $180 million. We only spent $140 million because we ended the trial early. And I had to stand corrected. CALGB, that's the Men's Eating and Living trial, that cost $2.5 million. Okay, the design of clinical trials, we randomize. Essentially, we flip a coin. You're in group A, you're in group B. Now, sometimes we'll randomize people to a couple of different treatments, but it's always essentially a flip of the coin which decides what people get. People are blinded. Subjects in a trial are not told, when it's possible, what they're getting. So there was a sclerotherapy trial, and Dr. Peter Lance, who was chair of gastroenterology at UB, sclerotherapy. They take a caustic solution, and these sclera are essentially varicose veins of the lower esophagus, and they can bleed. And if they bleed and bust, you can exsanguinate quickly. So this trial was, they would pass a needle down the person's gullet and inject this caustic solution into these sclera, and that would cause scar tissue to form, and the idea was that that would lessen the likelihood that these things would break. Now, because they wanted to keep the doctor who was treating patients ignorant of what they were getting, they actually had a drug person hand the person the substance, and he or she didn't know what was being used and what was being injected. So the person either got this caustic solution or got saline. The statistician often will be blinded. So in the study that we're doing now, where we're taking prostate cancer patients and changing their diets, the statistician will know only that there's a group A and a group B. And then after he tells us what group did better or did differently or did not do differently, then we will say, okay, this was, and we'll have another honest broker who will say, okay, that's the group of people that got dietary change or the group of people who didn't get dietary change. Now, it's not always possible. With a lot of the studies that I've been a part of, you can't really blind people to what they're getting. So in the polyp prevention trial, we took people who had had adenomatous polyps, and we changed their diet. So we had a group A and a group B. And we there was no way to keep these people blind as to what they were getting. If they were in the diet change part of the trial, we had a nutritionist working with them. We had three nutritionists working full-time for 2 years with 150 patients. And the other group, the other people who were the control patients, got nothing. So there was no way they didn't know what they were getting. In most drug trials, if they're beyond phase two, people will be blinded as to what they're getting. Women's Healthy Eating and Living Study. This was a dietary change trial for women who had successfully treated breast cancer, and they obviously knew what they were getting. In the Men's Eating and Living Study, CALGB 70807, they all knew that they were in an experimental protocol. And they knew they were either having their diets changed, they had a nutritionist calling them and pushing them to change their diet, or they were getting nothing. Okay, analysis of clinical trial data. You do a clinical trial to make it as simple as possible and also to make it as difficult as possible to get the wrong answer. So when you do a clinical trial, you've got a group A and you have a group B, and you literally can use chi-square to talk about the difference. Or you can use a comparison of means. You don't have to control for a bunch of confounding variables because you've taken them out of the picture by construction. Now, the endpoints have to be specified and they have to be limited in number. Often in drug trials, you will see people, there will be at least three categories of outcome. There will be cure, there will be response, and there will be partial response. Now, at least theoretically, the investigator should specify what he or she is looking for in the trial, and that one outcome should be the primary outcome, and that's what statistical power is based on. Now, I mentioned confounding by smoking in the wheat bran fiber trial. We did this trial at University of Arizona. We gave group A this Kellogg's All Bran, and we gave group B a Kellogg's All Bran without the fiber in it. And I don't know to this day what happened, but there was a statistically significant difference in smoking between the experimental and the control group. I don't know how it happened, but we had 1,400 subjects in this study, and the difference was much greater than you would expect on the basis of chance. So randomization is not perfect. You always have to check it, but and we thought we had done everything right, but we got that. We also had a problem with randomization in the wheat bran fiber trial, because we were asking people to consume a box of this Kellogg's All Bran or a box of this substitute per day, and some people found it onerous. One time I was doing it was before I went to the University of Arizona, I was watching a presentation by Dr. Alberts, who was the PI of this trial, and he had shown us the boxes in which this stuff came, and so I had opened one of them and was munching on the Kellogg's All Bran. And Dr. Alberts stopped in the middle of his presentation and he said, Jim, if I were you, I wouldn't eat any more of that stuff during the meeting. Also, in the polyp prevention trial, and this is true of anything in which you alter people's behavior, if alteration of their behavior causes any kind of inconvenience or problem for them, they're not going to participate. So I got a call when I was leading the polyp prevention trial, and this lady called me and she said, now what we were doing was pushing people to consume a lot more fiber, a lot more vegetables, and a lot less fat. And she called and said, Dr. Marshall, I've got a real problem with participating in this study. I have a very busy social life, and I play bridge with my friends. And what this high-fiber diet is doing to me, I can't have this. Flatulence and urgency and so on and so forth. So when you're doing a diet, when you're doing any kind of intervention in which people's behavior is affected, that can be a problem. Okay, chemotherapeutic trial is our model. We want to blind people. In prevention trials, it's difficult even if we're using a drug. So in the beta carotene trials that were done, people's skin turned orange. In the wheat bran fiber trial, people had changes in their bowel practices. In the kind of trials we do here for cancer patients, whether they're phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, the threat people face is a real one. They've got a serious disease that may take their life. In prevention trials, it's different. If we have 1,000 people who are at risk of prostate cancer, they may all be at risk of prostate cancer, but only 50 or 100 of them are going to get a serious progressive form of prostate cancer. So the threat is much more remote and it's much lower. In the cancer clinical trials we're doing here, that threat is real and it's immense. The likelihood of patient benefit. In a prevention trial, most of the people are going to be okay. It doesn't matter whether the intervention works or not. In a therapeutic trial, you're going to know pretty quickly if it works or not. And patients are better, or they're dead. Now, phases of clinical trial. Phase 1 tests only for safety and activity. Who do we do phase 1 trials with? Yeah. Yeah, you're at the end of the line, and there's, we'll, if you're willing, we'll try this drug on you and see if it has any activity. See if it turns out to be terribly toxic for you. Phase 2 trials, we look at activity against a specified biomarker. And there are different stages of phase 2 trials. So there are some in which we now randomize. I'm on the central IRB for NCI, for prevention studies. And we will, in most phase 2 trials, there's no randomization. But in some trials where we're looking for subtle physiological changes that people are aware of, we're actually randomizing now to make sure that the people who get both options are equivalent. And phase 3 is against a disease endpoint. And you want a good example of a phase 3 trial, look up Philip McCarthy's trial for multiple myeloma patients. It's probably the highest profile publication that's come out of Roswell in the past couple of years. Okay, screening trials. We do screening trials because, again, we want to know whether something really works or not. And there are 3 problems with screening trials. One is prognostic bias. So if you compare people who get mammographic screening against people who don't, and you say, well, the people who got screening did better. Well, the question is one of confounding. Would they have done better anyway? Were they healthier? Did they get more other medical care? Prognostic bias, lead time bias. We often look at 5-year survival in cancer patients. So if you screen them and your intervention makes absolutely no difference at all, but you've caught the disease earlier, that's lead time bias. It'll make it look like people survived longer because you screened them. And the most important criterion of effect in screening trials is survival. Okay, intent to treat analysis. We randomize people to a treatment. Now, in the men's eating and living study trial we're doing, our first evaluation has to be according, we'll have one group of people who were assigned to dietary change and one group of people who were assigned to nothing. And we will look at their survival and their development of metastatic disease according to the treatment assignment, not according to whether they participate or not. Now, in a lot of prevention trials especially, but also in treatment trials, some people just won't comply. And other people who were assigned to placebo will find out that they're on placebo and they will, they will use the drug. Now, there was in some of the early retrovirus treatment studies treatments for AIDS patients, there was a guy, Dave Beyer, who was gay and HIV positive. This was 20 years ago. And he was a well-known activist. And one of the problems with discovering what was going on with antiretroviral therapy was that people who were assigned to placebo were going to a laboratory, finding out what they were getting, and then going outside the study to get the real drug. And Dr. Beyer, not too long before he died, went to a number of groups and he said, look, we will never get an answer to this question if people don't take what they're assigned. Intent to treat analysis. We treat, we analyze the data according to the group to which people were assigned. I want to make one other note. You will sometimes see that people will talk about the study population. We don't study, in general, we don't study populations. We study samples from populations. So if you see a population, you say the study population was, well, the study, the population from which our sample was drawn is this or that. If you study a population, you don't have to use statistical significance. You have the answer for the population. Study power. Higher risk patients are valuable. In the study I was a part of with Arthur Schatzkin, we studied adenoma patients, and we were looking at recurrence of adenoma. Now, the reason for that was colorectal adenoma. The reason for that was because adenomas are much more common than colon cancer. So if we wanted to study colon, if we wanted to study diet and colon cancer, we would have had to study 30,000 people instead of 2,000. So adenomas are so much more common that if we had an effect, we would have been able to see it in 2,000 patients. In the in SWOG 9917, we were studying people who had high-grade intraepithelial neoplasia of the prostate. We were testing selenium. And we thought at the time that this was a very high-risk lesion. I remember telling people, it's prostate cancer looking for a place to happen. And so we had a relatively small sample. It was 450 men. It turns out it wasn't so high-risk, and selenium had no value at all. But the size of the sample is dependent on the risk of people in that sample. In the study by Parsons et al., that's the Men's Eating and Living study, we've got actual prostate cancer patients. And one of the things we've come to understand about prostate cancer is that it's much more common than we used to believe it was. When the prostate cancer prevention trial was designed, it was expected that something like 8 to 10% of the men who were examined at the end of the study would turn out to have prostate cancer. It turns out that it was 25%. And so the question is, what's the likelihood that prostate cancer, which is very common, what's the likelihood that it advances and becomes progressive? That's what we're studying in the Men's Eating and Living study. And we're expecting that something in the vicinity of 30 to 50% of people will develop progressive disease. Okay. One of the things we sacrifice in doing a clinical trial is basically we take a chance on external validity. So when we did the polyp prevention trial, I was doing it up at the University of Buffalo and randomizing, I enrolled 300 patients. Okay, we expected that something like 25 to 30% of the polyp patients who were eligible would join the study. It turned out to be 5%. So we had a very good answer, but it was in a really restricted group of patients. Now, as nearly as we could tell, those patients are like the other patients who didn't join the study, but the percentage of subjects was quite low. In the Men's Eating and Living study, we randomized 465 patients, but this was through the cooperative group, and we don't have any idea how many patients were possibly eligible for this thing. It could have been, it could readily have been 1,000, it could have been 2,000. So in a clinical trial, we sacrifice easy external validity for internal validity. We go for internal validity. We want to get the right answer, even if it's not in the general population. Um, Okay, sample size determination. I'm not sure we need to dwell on this. Okay, I want to talk about this, protocol development, and just a little bit about how long it takes to do a clinical trial. John Pierce and I started talking about this Men's Eating and Living study in 2000. It was about 2005. We got a protocol and pilot study funding in 2006. We did the study. We did a pilot study. We submitted an R01 in 2009. We got our grant award, our R01 grant award in 2010. Submitted our protocol to Cancer and Leukemia Group B, and they approved it in 2011. The Division of Cancer Prevention at NCI approved it in 2012. It was released to CALGB sites in 2013. We got our first patient in 2014, and we randomized our last patient in 2016, and we unblinded in the fall of 2017. So it took that long to get this thing finished. Long time to do clinical trials. They give us the right answer, but they take a long time. Eligibility and ineligibility have to be spelled out fairly carefully. There are stopping rules. So in this SELECT study, this is selenium and vitamin E for a chemo prevention trial. In that study, which had 35,000 men in it, it was stopped early because it was clear that it wasn't going to work. So you do a clinical trial because you think you're going to make a difference. If it becomes clear that you have made a difference or that you're not going to, the trial's over. We don't do clinical trials unless we're looking for an answer. If the IRB catches us doing a clinical trial to address a question that we already know the answer to, we'll be in trouble. The PCPT. Oh, in the prostate cancer prevention trial, that was a trial of a drug called finasteride, which prevents the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, and that had some 19,000 subjects in it. And it was stopped early because it was clear that finasteride decreased the risk of prostate cancer. And the DSMB said, Data Safety and Monitoring Board said, that's enough. I think I've talked about compliance and crossover. I think I've covered this. Oh, multi-center trial. Okay. In the polyp prevention trial, and there increasingly people are involved in multi-center trials, and it's important for those multi-center trials that the same protocol be used at each center. And so if a center, for example, in the oncology Association for Clinical Trials in Oncology, in their trials, their Memorial Sloan Kettering is a part of it. We are part. University of Chicago is part of it, and there are cancer centers all over the country. If the association opens a clinical trial, every center has to use exactly the same protocol. To the extent that it's possible. There is this conflict of interest. The PI wants the study to work. Statisticians, there's an issue with clinical trials. In the trials I have led at Roswell Park, I am not allowed to analyze the data. The data have to go to a statistician. And the when Dr. Yasko was here, I was arguing with her about it. She said, well, you're biased because you want the study to work. Of course I want the study to work. But so the data analysis is turned over to a statistician. I mentioned Robert Sandler. This was a CALGB protocol on aspirin and colorectal cancer. And this is how cooperative groups sometimes work. Bob was contacted by the statistical office, and the statistical office said, we've closed the trial because it's clear that it works. And he said, well, yeah, but don't you think you should have talked to the principal investigator? Well, sometimes these studies take on a life of their own, and it did in this case. Okay, funding. Some of you know that there was this interest in beta carotene as protective against cancer. And so in about 2000, there was the completion of what was called the CARROT trial, which was cancer and retinol, beta carotene and retinol. It was for lung cancer patients. And Dr. Gilbert Omen, who was then at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, was the PI. And he said he went to meetings and people said, how can you sleep at night? Because it's so clear that beta carotene protects against lung cancer. How can you do this? Well, it turned out that beta carotene not only didn't protect against lung cancer, it actually increased risk. That's, if you look up CAROT, you'll find the reference. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine. We were talking about doing spiral CT for detection of lung cancer and lessening the bad outcomes of lung cancer. And remember about 15 years ago, I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and he said, it's too late. Clinicians all over the place are doing it. Now, Claudia Henschke did the study anyway, and it did show a protective effect. Finally, people can be awfully sure about what is known. And we as scientists have to be agnostic. There are just almost every page of the New England Journal or issue of the New England Journal will have a very good idea for a cancer treatment or a cancer prevention intervention that didn't work. There you go. Questions? Thank you.